Good evening and welcome to the special truncated fundraising edition behind the news for July 28, 2005. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Since most of the show is taken up with fundraising appeals, I've just posted this interview with Chip Relay that made up most of the substance of the program. This program is the second I've done during WBAI's emergency fundraiser this July. If you're listening to this, please make a pledge to keep the station going. We rely on our listeners, and we're in pretty bad financial shape. To pledge, visit WBAI.org. There's a secure server there that will take your info and your money, which we desperately need. Let's set up the interview with this excerpt from the Mekon song, Insignificance. That from the Mekon song Insignificance from their 1994 album Retreat from Memphis. It's not clear exactly where they're coming down on the issue, or if they're even coming down on one side or the other, but the song does embody the paranoia at the base of conspiracy theories, and the way in which the positing of an all-powerful, masterful, secret elite renders most people insignificant. There's a deep resignation about the power to make social change at the base of a lot of the conspiracist mindset. I've been very disturbed at the popularity of 9/11 conspiracy premiums during this WBAI emergency fundraiser. So I thought I'd call Chip Berlay, the veteran researcher of the right wing at Political Research Associates in Somerville, Massachusetts, and ask him to talk about these stories and the conspiratorial impulse in general. Since the original broadcast of this show generated a fusillade of hostile emails, let me make a couple of things clear. Yes, some conspiracies do exist. COINTELPRO is a conspiracy. The Tuskegee syphilis experiment was one, too. More broadly, we have a ruling class and a business elite that plan important things over the long term. But much of that planning goes on in the open. Tenacious, smart journalists and academics can figure out what's been going on. But the notion that small groups of people can orchestrate the course of history is wildly wrong. History happens because of complicated forces, the interplay of intentions, conflict, and accident. It's messy and full of contradictions. It's not easy to understand the structure of society or history, but if you want to change things for the better, that is, in the direction of egalitarianism and peace, then you've got to do that work. It would change nothing to prove that Dick Cheney engineered 9/11. There may be a magical hope that the people would wake up if that were proven, but that can't be proven, and the people won't wake up in one single act. All the structures of domination and exploitation would remain, as would all the distortions in our consciousness that are the products of a nasty society. So here's Chip Berlay. If you want to read some of his and his colleagues' work, visit publiceye.org. Here's Chip Berlay. So conspiracism is everywhere.
Alas, it's true.
9/11 conspiracism is one of its fresher iterations.
Every major traumatic event in American history has been wrapped in conspiracist rhetoric.
So let's just start with a little. What do you think of the lay of the land of 9/11 conspiracism? We've got Tarpley, we've got, Griffin. What do you make of all this stuff?
Not very good research, lots of supposition, no paying attention to ideas of logic, evidence, which is, you know, a high school student can debunk, and a complete waste of time when there is so much evidence on the public record of malfeasance, misfeasance, and nonfeasance by the Bush administration. Why are we wasting time trying to show that Dick Cheney flew the plane by remote control with some secret device in the basement of a giant, you know, building on Wall Street surrounded by the Illuminati, Jewish bankers, and God knows, lizard aliens?
Devotees of this line of inquiry like to point to Cheney was running some drill that morning, the morning of 9/11, on a NORAD drill about multiple air hijackings. Is there any evidence for this stuff, and how do people spin these theories out?
Well, you know, readiness exercises and drills go on all the time. So the question is not whether or not there was a readiness exercise going on. There undoubtedly was. The question is, what does that have to do with anything? On any given day, somewhere in the world, the government of the United States, military, and other agencies are running a readiness exercise. It can range from a high school participating in a disaster drill to major theater of operations exercise. People who are completely incompetent in analyzing military activity and military jargon will make a big thing out of this, but in fact, it is not a big thing. We have readiness exercise plans for invading Canada. That doesn't mean that we're about to or that there's a conspiracy to invade Canada. This is simply bad research.
There seems to be an assumption in a lot of this theorizing that our leaders are incredibly competent and they can pull off massive feats like orchestrating the 9/11 hijacking with almost perfect aplomb. What about this fantasy of omnipotence that the masters of conspiracy are usually have attributed to them?
Well, the idea of omnipotence is crucial, but we have to understand, let's give a little room here for why people are so angry. It's true the government is lying to them. It's true that we're getting a raw deal. It's true that in history we can point to a number of conspiracies that have been revealed in terms of government activity, ranging from the Gulf of Tonkin to the Tuskegee syphilis experiments to, you know, a dozen other things that are horrifying. The COINTELPRO program itself could take days to explain the level of conspiracies that went on in terms of government illegal activity in that program alone. The dilemma here is to then make the fallacy of logic that since it happened before, it must be happening now. And that's where the omnipotence comes in, because if it's happening now, the way we can explain it is by assuming that an elaborate, omnipotent plan involving hundreds, if not thousands of people, was coordinated by, on one day we think Bush is incompetent, but on days that we're conspiracy theorists, he is Machiavellian and also, you know, apparently has the power of the Force and Darth Vader. So it is this idea that such an elaborate plan involving so many hundreds and thousands of people could have been pulled off without a hitch. And the fact is, these things never get pulled off without a hitch. The Gulf of Tonkin gets exposed. The Tuskegee experiments get exposed. But they're not exposed by conspiracy theorists. They're exposed by people painstakingly going through public records as they're released or demanding that public records be released. So if you want to have a 911 truth commission that is anything other than a gigantic waste of time, focus on demanding that every piece of paper is declassified immediately and made public, and then we can have a sensible conversation about who should be indicted in the Bush administration for what they did prior to 9/11 in failing to protect us, and then what they did after 9/11 to cover up their own grotesque incompetence.
Well, and the other, even though that there's this masterful perfection attributed to these guys, they also leave behind gaping clues that amateurs with websites can decode.
You know, sometimes that happens, and there are amateurs with websites who can find information and put it up on the web, and it's really quite amazing sometimes. But, you know, the dilemma here is people who make claims that, you know, are simple to debunk. My favorite, and I've talked about this, is this guy who claimed that he couldn't find this particular radio reporter on the web. Therefore, he said this person didn't exist and that all of these reports about a plane hitting the Pentagon had been invented by some vast conspiracy. Well, I mean, you know, radio reporters, they don't report on the web. Get it? He's a radio reporter. You have to find him by calling, you know, the people who employ him who put stuff on, guess what, the radio. So, I mean, this is the level of incompetence that is displayed in many of these websites. We see claims that jet fuel doesn't explode. It explodes all the time. We see claims that, you know, the temperature in the fire never got hot enough to melt steel. Doesn't matter. If it's hot enough to deform the steel because of structural failure, things will collapse. Buildings don't collapse down. Yes, they do. You know, it's on and on and on. The most outlandish claims, you know, three people said a missile hit the Pentagon. Well, 3,000 were watching when a plane hit the Pentagon. So it's a relentless refusal to pay attention to any piece of evidence that contradicts their preconceived conspiracist notion.
Let's talk a bit about the politics of this. Historically, conspiracy theories have been very popular on the right, which fits in with a certain paranoid populist tendency on the American right. It's been over the last couple of decades that the left has increasingly been enamored of conspiracy theories. What do you attribute this this spreading across the spectrum to?
Well, a lot of this starts back when the Christic Institute began to make claims about a secret team, which then really were based in reporting by two right-wing organizations, the Lyndon LaRouche Organization and the Spotlight, which at the time was a Willis Carto operation. And, you know, the Christic people, through Danny Sheehan, began to take these claims from these two right-wing conspiracy theory publications of LaRouche and Carto, and weave them into a narrative which was then turned around and peddled to various liberal and left foundations for hundreds of thousands of dollars. A giant lawsuit was completely derailed by focusing on these paranoid conspiracy claims. And his own clients later complained that he had, you know, destroyed the case with these paranoid conspiracy claims. I would say that that's where a lot of this stuff began to be more and more acceptable on the left. And then you start to see, during the first Gulf War, the inclusion of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories as well as anti-Arab conspiracy theories in the El Sabah family conspiracy theory spread by Craig Hewlett on Pacifica stations. They're really mirror images, you know, the giant global Jewish banker Mossad conspiracy theory and Craig Hewlett's, you know, El Sabah oil oligarchy conspiracy theory were just, you know, mirror images of each other, and neither have had any validity whatsoever. And more you see people on the left who have abandoned any kind of institutional or systemic or structural analysis grabbing onto conspiracy theories because at least they offer some sort of explanation. It's a false explanation, but at least it's an explanation.
What you call there's a psychology 101 explanation, too. It appeals to people who feel powerless, right?
Right. Well, if you feel powerless and you feel that the government is not acting in your best interest, well, first I would say you're right, and that's a completely correct analysis of how they want you to feel. But in fact, you're not powerless. But what happens when you embrace a conspiracy theory is that you make yourself powerless. It becomes you against this gigantic, vast, omnipotent, omniscient conspiracy. It's very disempowering. The other thing it does is it relieves you from having to take any responsibility for being a citizen of the United States and sharing the complicity in the actions of the United States that provoke terrorism against our country. I don't think terrorism is justified. I do not celebrate what happened on 9/11, but I understand why people are angry at us. And I have to take responsibility for that, just like I took responsibility for being an American citizen during the Vietnam War, and I went and did civil disobedience to make it clear that I drew the line and I did not want my persona being used as someone who was complicit. But a conspiracy theory is very handy because it not only makes you completely innocent, but it makes the scapegoat that you've erected to blame everything on completely evil. So you're good and innocent, the scapegoat is evil and complicit, and you don't really have to examine the more complex issues in which you may play a role.
Why do Jews play such a prominent role in conspiracy theories? You know, right after the London bombings the other week, we heard people claiming that the Mossad was behind it, or at least had some knowledge of it. What is it about Jews that make them so such prominent actors in so many conspiracy theories?
Well, one explanation, and it's not mine, it's been put around for years, is that you know, anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools. It's the idea that at a time in the Middle Ages and in Europe, when Jews were the only people able to lend money, and when money stopped being a flock of sheep or a piece of gold, but it began to be coins and paper currency, there was something magical and something conspiratorial about the handling of money in banks. You know, you brought stuff in, they took it, somehow they made more money with it in your mind. And so Jews became tied to this kind of idea of the magical nature of a cash and currency-based economy. And so it was very easy because Jews have been ghettoized geographically in various places and ghettoized in terms of the kinds of professions that they could hold, that they easily became then associated with powerful forces which the average person did not understand. And so in Europe, there developed this thesis then in people's minds. It was really more a meme or a trope or a metaphor in which Jews were those agents by which horrible things were done by unseen forces to the average person.
There's some congruity with a lot of populist politics in the sense that that there's an underlying structure of goodness, the productive people versus a conspiratorial, parasitical elite. And if we could just somehow clear away the bad folks, things would flourish in health. Is there some connection between that kind of populism and the conspiracy impulse?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Producerism as a concept basically argues that there's a good capitalism and a bad capitalism. And, you know, this is very similar to the kind of argument you could hear from Pat Buchanan, where, you know, the industrial force of America, you know, the business nationalist kind of view that productive capital is industrial capital and financial capital is parasitic capital. Well, you know, there's no such thing as a good or bad version of unregulated, aggressive free market capitalism. And so once you divide it into good and bad sectors and you say the bad sector is financial, it is easily then to look at the world as the good industrial and hardworking producers in the middle, now, of course, spread through a variety of different economic sectors in terms of service or intellectual work, whatever, that the productive forces of the middle, their pockets are being picked by elite parasites up above and lazy, sinful, and subversive parasites down below. And the framework for producerism in populism always starts out with people shaking their fist at the elite secret parasites above, who don't really exist, because they really are structural forces that exist. But you stereotype the elite forces up above. But then when you get tired of doing that because you don't seem to be succeeding in rooting out the eight white guys drinking bourbon on Wall Street who run everything, you really start to stamp down on the people below you on the socioeconomic ladder in America. So historically, producerist populism, which is what a lot of these conspiracy theories are rooted in about 9/11, ends up building a mass movement that turns around and stomps on Indian nations, stomps on black people, stomps on immigrants, stomps on women, stomps on homosexuals, stomps on anyone who is seen as a sinful, lazy, or subversive person in this model. And, you know, it's a pretty gruesome reality. And the book Right-Wing Populism in America that I co-wrote, we wrote it because we wanted people to understand that this model leads to oppression of people in the United States who are overwhelmingly more poor and more non-white than the populist center.
How does this fit in with the very popular right-wing fantasy that there's a liberal elite that's directing things at the detriment of the good masses?
Obviously, if there's a liberal elite, I wish they'd get going, because you know, I don't see them running the country. This is a long-term fantasy that goes back to the New Deal and really a kind of construction of reality in which Roosevelt, FDR, was seen as introducing a kind of collectivism to the U.S. that sapped the strength and vigor of America and weakened it both morally, financially, and in terms of foreign powers. And you know, you read this stuff in publications like The Freeman, which was a libertarian journal in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, people track this back to, you know, a memo that Lewis Powell wrote. This is stuff that people were writing about the New Deal in the 1930s. And so it's very much this idea of the liberal elite comes out of this right-wing populist movement against Roosevelt that was really manipulated by wealthy elites. And as a historic phenomena, this has always benefited wealthy elites, this kind of producerist populism and the idea that there are liberal elites who the masses have to rise up and crush. And what really happens is what gets crushed is any attempt to make the system deal with redistributing income or social, economic, or gender equality.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, there certainly have been conspiracies in history, COINTELPRO, the Spanish-American War, whatever. And also, we can certainly see that there is a ruling class in the United States that exerts a tremendous power through certain institutions. So how do we separate that kind of analysis? I mean, the fact that, first of all, on one hand, there really are some conspiracies in history, and there is a ruling class that operates through very elite institutions, sometimes semi-openly and sometimes not. How do we separate the wheat from the chaff in this kind of analysis?
I think it's very important to understand that there are elites, but they aren't individuals who are bad. There's not an otherwise wonderful and equitable functioning system that has been distorted somehow by these secret elites. Elites are institutional. I think really the important thing is to look at the difference between, say, the work of a C. Wright Mills or a G. William Domhoff or a Holly Sklar, and the kinds of allegations made by a Michael Rupert or a David Ray Griffin or a Craig Hewlett or any of a dozen other people. I mean, I interviewed Domhoff about this recently, and he said, he studies how elites strive to develop consensus, which is through publicly observable organizations like corporate boards, policy planning networks. These things can be studied in detail. And he says that, that's real different from the idea of a small, secretive, illegitimate conspiracy, his quote. Because this large group called the power elite is known to the public, it clearly states its aims, profit, profit, and more profit, and less government, and it publishes its policy suggestions and is seen as legitimate by a great majority of the public, end quote. So Donoff is saying these aren't secret elites. There is no secret team. There is no secret group of people who run America. It's a structural system in which certain people rise to the top, but they're replaceable. Look, if you gun down everybody on your list of the secret elites, and I'm not suggesting that you do, tomorrow there'd be other faces holding those positions and nothing would change. It's a complete and utter waste of time to follow conspiracy theory as a way to develop any kind of progressive social change.
Yeah, well, I've always been struck since I've been following this stuff for the last 20 years, how much goes on in the open in American society. You can learn an awful lot just by reading a daily newspaper, if people still do that.
Well, this is what made people like George Seldes and I.F. Stone and G. William Domhoff famous. They were able to expose the machinations and, indeed, even some conspiracies of elites in power simply by going to the historical record and the public record, whether it was on daily newspaper. I mean, you can find more about conspiracies in Forbes that you're ever going to find on the From the Wilderness website.
Finally, what is this really damaging in any way, or should we just consider this something of an amusing vice, like reading the gossip pages?
Oh, no, it's very damaging. It not only is a waste of time, it's worse because it trains people to think about the world in a way that's dysfunctional for organizers. The world is not run by a handful of secret elites. If you're going to organize for social change, it's a magical formula that's being prescribed by conspiracy theorists. Somehow you're going to find the 11 bad people and you're going to expose them and suddenly everything will change? How? Let's see if we could line up all the people who allegedly shot Kennedy and put them on a stage and reveal who they were. There would still be social inequality. There would still be racism. There would still be sexism. There would still be homophobia. There would still be anti-Semitism, Arabophobia, Islamophobia. There would still be people going to bed hungry at night. What you do when you promote conspiracy theory is you make sure that all of the people working really hard to affect real change in America are completely swept aside by a hysteric mob racing towards a fantasy.